From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Israeli-Gaza offensive resumes. Latest on tensions in Nigeria over kidnapped schoolgirls. No quick end in sight for the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. Plus, remembering a celebrated conductor, Lauren Mazel. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Israel and Palestinian militants intensified attacks against each other on Tuesday after the collapse of a ceasefire deal to end the conflict, which began last week. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports from Gaza, where Palestinians say they hope for an end to the conflict, but not on Israel's terms.
The leaders of Hamas, the Palestinian political authority in Gaza, have rejected an Egyptian proposal for a ceasefire accepted earlier in the day by Israel. Hamas says it was not included in discussions of the deal, which called for a temporary ceasefire to begin Tuesday, the opening of the borders with Gaza, and talks between Hamas and Israel to take place in Cairo. Officials from the group have also insisted on further conditions, including the lifting of an Israeli blockade on the Palestinian territory. Israeli Defense Forces began a campaign of airstrikes in Gaza last week to counter Palestinian rocket fire aimed at Israel. Israel's military observed a ceasefire for several hours on Tuesday, but resumed airstrikes against Hamas targets, saying the militants were continuing to fire rockets at Israel. Gazan officials say at least 180 Palestinians have been killed so far in the Israeli offensive, the majority of them civilians, while hundreds of homes have been destroyed. The streets of Gaza are virtually deserted, as many people have been staying inside or relocating to UN-run schools to avoid being caught in the crossfire. In Gaza City, fruit vendor Mohammed Saman says he has few customers at his stall in the usually crowded Shati market. He says he supports Hamas's position. I want a ceasefire, but under the conditions of Hamas, not Israel, he says. And I want all the bombarded houses to be rebuilt. Palestinian newspaper columnist and independent analyst Talal Okal says the Israeli military operations have only helped to shore up popular support for Hamas.
For the moment, the popularity of Hamas increased, you know, because the people saw something happen for the first time, you know. That the resistance is ready and able to respond, to defend, to do something, you know.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, speaking in Vienna Tuesday, condemned Hamas for continuing rocket fire into Israel, despite what he called a goodwill effort to secure a ceasefire. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Gaza.
And also in the news, Iraq's fractious parliament moved a step closer Tuesday to resolving its political stalemate by naming Sunni lawmaker Salim al-Jaburi as speaker. Under an informal agreement in place since the 2003 U.S. military invasion toppled dictator Saddam Hussein, a Sunni holds the speaker's chair while a Kurd is president and a Shiite will be prime minister. With Jaburi's election, parliament now has 30 days to elect a president, who then has 15 days to ask the largest bloc in parliament to pick a prime minister to form a new government. Recent events in Iraq, including the sweep of the country by the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, also known as ISIL, have resulted in the Kurds in the north reconsidering a centuries-old dream of independence. Kurdish regional president Masoud Barzani recently said that independence is now inevitable. VOA's Jeffrey Young is in Erbil, the capital and largest city in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. He speaks now with my colleague Susan Yaki about the successful economic development there in spite of all that's happening in Iraq.
Over all of Iraq, the economy is not that strong. Look at what is happening right now with ISIL taking a big chunk of the country. People do not want to put money in places that are going to be overrun by insurgents, or their business is going to be taken away, or even worse, everybody gets killed. The big difference here, Kurdistan is stable, and again, as I said before, it respects investment. And if Kurdistan becomes an independent state that issues its own currency, its currency will be immensely strong, like the euro or some other major currency in the West, because it is backed by the oil in the ground, it's backed by the strong economy, and it's backed by opportunity.
Jeff, are people there confident that ISIL will not invade this region?
I know from my firsthand experience from being with the Peshmerga before in 2004 and 2005, this is the strongest military force in this entire region. ISIL has not tried to come anywhere near Erbil. It has not tried to go into Kurdistan at all. They know better. They know that if they come here, they get killed. The Peshmerga will not let anyone defeat them. I have seen this with my own eyes.
VOA's Jeffrey Young speaking with my colleague Susan Yaki from Erbil, Iraq. Still ahead on VOA's International Edition, no deal yet on Iran's nuclear agenda.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has ended 3 days of talks in Vienna with his Iranian counterpart without breaking the deadlock over the future of Iran's nuclear program. But lower-level talks will continue at least until Sunday, the deadline to reach a long-term agreement. VOA's Al Pessin is in Vienna with our report.
Secretary Kerry told a news conference there has been progress in the talks with Iran and the other five countries deputized by the UN Security Council. He says an agreement is possible, but it remains out of reach.
We have all continued to negotiate in good faith. But after my conversations here with both Iran and with our P5 plus one partners in particular, it is clear that we still have more work to do.
Kerry declined to provide details of the remaining disputes, but they're believed to center on how much capacity Iran will be allowed for the enrichment of uranium and how long the restrictions will last. Enrichment is an essential step in preparing fuel for nuclear facilities, both for peaceful and military purposes. An agreement would include the reduction and eventual end of international economic sanctions that have crippled Iran's economy. Iran says its nuclear program is and always will be purely peaceful, but Secretary Kerry made clear Iran must take concrete steps to guarantee that.
The first test is to answer the questions and come up with a formula that says to the world, this is a peaceful nuclear program, and it cannot be used to make weapons, and we know that to a certainty.
In an interview with the New York Times, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said Iran is willing to freeze its enrichment program for a few years, but not to reduce it. The international negotiators are believed to be seeking a reduction from current levels for a decade or more. Foreign Minister Zarif had this to say after a final meeting with Secretary Kerry on Tuesday.
Iran has made the choice to engage, and we have shown in the last 6 months that in spite of all the obstacles, we have lived up to all our commitments. We are prepared to continue to do so. And we have shown that we are a serious negotiating partner. This government means business. We're here to resolve this. And we will resolve it, provided that everybody understands that we need to go forward together. This is not a one-way street. This is a two-way street.
The effort is complicated by hardline views among some leaders in both Iran and the United States. Iran's supreme leader recently spoke of increasing Iran's enrichment capability by nearly 20 times. But Secretary Kerry did not seem concerned, saying he'd heard the figure before and it represents a long-term plan. Still, many experts believe that while the diplomats and their technical teams probably can work out an agreement, conservative politicians in both the United States and Iran may not accept it. Iran expert Ali Vaez of the International Crisis Group.
These negotiations are more informed by constraints of domestic politics than by real imperatives of national interest.
Still, Vaez says an acceptable agreement can be reached, although probably not by Sunday, and he's not surprised that the talks are going down to the last minute and quite possibly beyond. Secretary Kerry said if there's no accord by Sunday, the United States will assess the progress and the prospects for more and then decide whether to agree on an extension. Al Pessin, VOA News, Vienna.
A planned meeting between Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan and the parents of schoolgirls held captive by Boko Haram militants has been abruptly canceled. Mr. Jonathan blamed the development on what he called political forces within the social media campaign called Bring Back Our Girls. An activist with the group told VOA the families were insulted that the president had only agreed to the meeting after he was asked to do so by the Pakistani girls' education advocate Malala Yousafzai. Campaign had previously criticized Mr. Jonathan's response to the kidnappings and his failure to visit the families of the abducted girls in their hometown. Meantime, Human Rights Watch says the Boko Haram insurgency has left more than 2,000 people dead in just the first 6 months of the year. They say the attacks amount to crimes against humanity. We get more now from VOA's Joe DiCapua.
HRW's West Africa director, Corinne Dufka, says Boko Haram is effectively waging a war on the people of northeastern Nigeria at a staggering human cost.
We have documented 95 attacks on 70 towns and villages, mostly in northeastern Nigeria.
There have also been attacks on the capital, Abuja. Confirmation of the 2,053 deaths is based on media reports, human rights groups, and others.
We analyzed these reports looking at, again, credible reports of morgue workers, local officials, civilians, witnesses who had seen the bodies buried or registered. And we came up with this figure, which is probably conservative, actually, given the numbers of attacks.
She says the attacks have dramatically increased since a state of emergency was declared in three northern states. It took effect in Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states in May 2013. The report says there's also been a dramatic increase this year in casualties from bomb blasts, including suicide bombings. Dufka says they should be viewed as crimes against humanity,
including murder, torture, rape, and others that are committed as part of what we call a widespread or systematic attack. And we believe that the nature of these attacks, the similarity, the organized nature in which they're being committed, suggests that they really are crimes against humanity.
One of Boko Haram's most infamous attacks was the kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls in Chibok in April. However, Human Rights Watch says there have been many attacks on schools where male students were often killed. In February, an attack on the federal government college in Bunyadi in Yobe State left 59 boys dead. Dufka says Human Rights Watch and others also have documented abuses by Nigerian security forces. It says these include use of excessive force, arbitrary detention, the burning of homes, and the extrajudicial killing of those suspected of supporting Boko Haram.
The government of Nigeria, regardless of how egregious these attacks are, they have to abide by international law when responding to them.
She says the Nigerian government must not only protect the population against Boko Haram attacks, but also security forces that may operate outside the law. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
French soldier has been killed in a suicide attack in northern Mali as the French government moves to set up a new counter-jihadist force in the region. On Thursday, French President François Hollande travels to West Africa. His visit comes as the French government is preparing to draw up that new military operation that will target Islamist extremists in Mali, Chad, as well as Niger. World Health Organization says the Ebola epidemic circulating in three West African countries shows no sign of diminishing and fears it is likely to continue for many months. Latest WHO figures put the number of cases of this deadly disease at 964, including 603 deaths. Lisa Schlein has more from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The deadly Ebola virus is continuing to spread in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia nearly 4 months after it was first detected in remote forest communities of Guinea. There is no vaccine or cure for the virus, which is spread through direct contact with bodily fluids from an infected person. The World Health Organization reports Ebola victims in West Africa are dying at a rate of 60%. WHO spokesman Dan Epstein says it probably will be several months before governments and health agencies get a grip on this epidemic and cases of the disease start going down.
It is pretty horrifying. I think anytime you have an epidemic that has a case fatality rate of above 50%, where more than half the people infected die, it is horrifying. So, of course, we're very worried, and that's why we're increasing our efforts. In terms of how long it will take, it's very hard to predict. It depends on our success in the five important areas of epidemiology, contact tracing, education, very importantly, community level participation, changing of habits of burial, practices.
There have been periodic outbreaks of Ebola in Africa since it was first detected in the mid-1970s in the Democratic Republic of Congo, then known as Zaire. This is the first outbreak of the disease in West Africa, and it is proving to be the deadliest on record. Since people have no experience with the disease, they do not know how the virus is transmitted. People often refuse treatment because they are suspicious of health workers. Epstein says this is a huge impediment towards stopping its spread. He says it is important to trace all people who have been in contact with an infected person in order to contain the disease. He tells VOA it is very difficult for foreign health workers to get into communities because they are viewed with hostility, intimidated, and often driven away by the residents.
It's really kind of a matter of rumor control. It's myths and facts. So we have to dispel these myths about Ebola that are prevalent and that are circulating as rumors that are very damaging, you know, like the myth that foreigners are bringing Ebola to your villages, or that if you go to the hospital, you will die and they will take your organs, or crazy myths like that are hard to dispel. So it's early to say whether we're being successful, but we're certainly increasing our effort in education and social mobilization in villages in all of the three countries.
Epstein says WHO is reaching out to religious and traditional leaders for help in gaining the confidence of villagers so health workers can break this damaging cycle of suspicion and bring the epidemic to an end. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Committee to Protect Journalists is condemning a push by the South African Broadcasting Corporation's new chief for reporters to be licensed. VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg.
The new chief of South Africa's public broadcaster, Claudie Motsoeneng, had already raised the ire of many South Africans when he said he had a high school diploma, called him a trick. He does not. But he further raised hackles by demanding that journalists in Africa's most established and boisterous media landscape be licensed to practice. Motsoeneng says media licensing is necessary. He says some journalists are lazy, make up facts, and are not objective, although he did not give specific examples. He also says South African journalists too often miss what he described as good news about the government's efforts to improve the lives of South Africans. He says he will make a formal submission on this idea to the nation's communications minister. Unsurprisingly, the pronouncement has been met with derision by journalists, professionals who are paid to ask and say what most people are too afraid or embarrassed to ask and say. South Africa's National Editors Forum has condemned the proposal and criticized Motsoeneng for what it calls his ignorance of journalistic practice. On Tuesday, the International Committee to Protect Journalists joined the fray, saying South African journalists have earned the right to report freely after decades of oppression and censorship under apartheid. CPJ's Africa Program Coordinator, Sue Valentine.
We are very concerned that the head of the public broadcaster is thinking in terms of licensing journalists, because we believe that that is not the job of the head of a public broadcaster, and also it totally takes South African press freedom, which is hard won, takes it backwards.
Valentine also says that Motsoeneng's argument that doctors and lawyers are licensed should not apply to journalists. In fact, she says his proposal flies in the face of South Africa's constitution.
The difference is that a doctor or a lawyer is a profession, whereas journalists deal with the issue of the fundamental human right of freedom of expression and the right to access to information. And these are human rights in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, and in South Africa's constitution. So the right of freedom of expression and access to information is at the heart of what journalists do, and for that reason, journalists should not be licensed.
Motsoeneng says he will stand firm by his proposal, whose fate, without a doubt, will be closely followed by journalists. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Celebrated conductor Lauren Mazel has died. It was earlier this week. VOA's Eric Felton has a look now at his long and extraordinary career.
That's Lauren Mazel at the podium conducting the Vienna Philharmonic in a performance of Ravel's Bolero. In a career that stretched over more than seven decades, Mazel led orchestras, conducted operas, and mentored a new generation of young conductors. Mazel began his own career at age 9 when he conducted an orchestra at the 1939 New York World's Fair. 2 years later, he conducted the NBC Symphony at Radio City Music Hall. After college, Mazel toured the world acting as a guest conductor before settling in to lead several top orchestras, including the Orchestre National de France, the Deutsche Opera, the Cleveland Orchestra, and the Vienna State Opera. Among the many orchestras Mazel conducted was the Pittsburgh Symphony, where he was music director from 1988 to 1996. Kirk Muspratt was a resident conductor at the symphony, working under Mazel.
The most astonishing thing about Mr. Mazel was his prodigious memory. I remember even when I was a student in Vienna, I went to see Carmen one night, and there was an announcement that the conductor who was supposed to conduct, Carmen, had taken very, very ill, and they took him to the hospital. Mr. Mazel was the music director of the opera at the time in Vienna. They called him, and he said, oh, no problem. I'll just put my shoes on and come over and conduct. 15 minutes later, he was there in a gray leisure suit conducting Carmen from memory.
In 2008, when Mazel was at the helm of the New York Philharmonic, the orchestra was invited to perform in the capital of North Korea, a concert that proved controversial. Though the U.S. State Department encouraged the Philharmonic's trip to Pyongyang, many pundits criticized the concert as giving credibility to North Korea's repressive regime. Mazel responded to his critics, writing in the Wall Street Journal that artists have a broader role to play in the public arena, but it must be totally apolitical, nonpartisan, and free of issue-specific agendas. The goal, he wrote, was to bring peoples and their cultures together on common ground. Mazel died Sunday in rural Rappahannock County, Virginia, where he and his wife, Dietlinda Turbin Mazel, had turned their farm into the site of a summer music festival. The Mazels founded the Castleton Festival in 2009 to give promising young musicians the opportunity to perform in high-level productions and learn from famous artists.
That was VOA's Eric Felton reporting. Lauren Mazel was 84 years old when he died on Sunday. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Always good to have you with us. And we want you to forget that you can find us anytime on the Internet at voanews.com. The latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On July 16, 1945, the United States set off the first atomic explosion. The explosion was the result of work done by the Manhattan Project during World War II. The blast in the desert of New Mexico would lead to the development of two nuclear bombs that were dropped on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Late on the night of July 16, 1918, Bolshevik revolutionaries executed Nicholas Romanov, the deposed Tsar of Russia, and his family. Nicholas had been forced to abdicate the throne after years of war. Taken prisoner by the Bolsheviks, the Tsar and his family were shot when anti-Bolshevik forces neared the town where the Romanovs were being held. In 1981, Mahathir Mohamad became Malaysia's fourth prime minister. He was to become Asia's longest-serving political leader. On this day in 1999, John F. Kennedy Jr., the son of the former U.S. president, died along with his wife and her sister when the single-engine plane he was piloting crashed into the ocean off the coast of the U.S. state of Massachusetts. July 16th is the traditional beginning of the Islamic year, which commemorates the day in 622 when Muhammad and his followers fled Mecca during a period of religious persecution. In 1966, on this date, the American pop band The Lovin' Spoonful released a song that 3 weeks later would become a number one hit. Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting good. Summer in the City was The Lovin' Spoonful's only number one hit, but 10 years later, the group's lead singer, John Sebastian, would score a number one single on his own with Welcome Back, the theme song to the 1970s television show Welcome Back, Cotter. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There were many notable outcomes at the recently concluded 26th session of the United Nations Human Rights Council, or UNHRC, in Geneva, Switzerland. The Council adopted its first-ever resolution on human rights in Ukraine, calling for continued cooperation and monitoring of the human rights situation throughout the entire country, and condemned ongoing abuses taking place in Russian-occupied Crimea and committed by separatists in the eastern parts of the country. U.S. Ambassador to the UNHRC, Keith Harper, said the resolution will offer an opportunity for the High Commissioner's office to have a more sustained role in Ukraine.
It will also help in technical assistance in the sense of aiding to understanding how do you address problems that arise. Sometimes they arise with state actors, oftentimes they arise with non-state actors. And so how do you deal with those issues? The High Commissioner's office has great experience in that.
The Human Rights Council, or HRC, passed its 14th resolution regarding the Syrian conflict, condemning serious abuses of human rights and violations of international humanitarian law in Syria, lamenting the lack of an international criminal court referral, and reiterating the international community's demand for unfettered humanitarian access in Syria.
The Assad regime is a murderous regime, and they are killing their own people. And so whatever action we can take at the Council to push them to find a political solution, in my view, is action that we ought to take. So when we see these grave human rights abuses, it's incumbent on the Council to continue to act. They did continue to act. They ratcheted up the response. For the first time in the operative paragraphs, we called for accountability through either domestic or international criminal bodies.
On South Sudan, the HRC adopted a consensus resolution that condemned human rights abuses and violations of international humanitarian law, including targeted killings, unlawful recruitment of child soldiers, and sexual violence and rape, that has occurred since mid-December 2013. The outcomes of this session underscored the importance of robust U.S. engagement at the Human Rights Council, where the United States continues to work with a diverse range of countries from all regions to address urgent human rights concerns. U.S. leadership continues to help keep the Council at the forefront of international efforts to promote and protect human rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.